Good evening and welcome to Deep Dive with Dr. Tracy. I am your host, Dr. Tracy Pearson. It is wonderful to have you here. I hope that you've had a great week. I can say that it has been a crazy week, crazy couple weeks for me. And I am so grateful to be with you here tonight. It may be part of my upbringing. It may have something to do with my New England roots, but I don't think you push ahead with something that you can't do well just to do it. And such was the case last week. A combination of Omicron and voting rights being at the very tippy top of the newscast made it really hard to put on a show that I wanted to do. So we're doing it this week. And I am really excited about it. Last week, we celebrated Martin Luther King Jr. And Martin Luther King Jr. Day on Monday. It wasn't just a three-day weekend. It's there for a purpose. It's a day designated by the federal government to honor the birthday of a murdered Black man, a Black man who relentlessly pursued civil rights and sought equality, including securing and protecting the right to vote. Now, in the past, I've expressed dismay on this show about lack of knowledge and lack of understanding. Indeed, it is the very driving force behind this show. I find myself staring into the abyss of Facebook at ignorant comments about topics that folks don't understand. And it drives me a little crazy because we have Google. So you could Google it if you wanted to learn about it, right? In theory. So I can't emphasize enough that history is important. If we don't know history, we lose perspective. It makes it harder to appreciate where we are and what's happening. And history is always told through the eyes of the person or people who write it, which means it's not free from implicit bias. Now, before you go away and you say that implicit bias stuff, stop, I don't want to hear about it, I'd like you to listen. Now, I've done quite a bit of research on implicit bias, and I don't mean the Google kind. I actually conducted a study involving implicit bias. I want to depoliticize that phrase, implicit bias. It can be a word that turns ears off. I don't want you to turn your ears off. On this show, when I use that term, what it means in my mind is the unconscious beliefs that guide our actions as a result of brain processes. You might not hear that on other shows. These brain processes are essentially survival mechanisms that are challenged by more information than the brain was originally designed to handle. You see, more information and more ways of getting information came into being, but the original model, the original hardware, really didn't change that much. So the brain struggles a bit at times. It becomes overwhelmed, and sometimes it takes an easy route that may not be the correct one. In future shows, we're going to explore that. But for tonight, I want you to keep that in mind. And I want you to keep it in mind this week. If you do nothing else this week, I want you to think about what you're reading. Who's the source? Why do they want me to believe that? Where did they get it from? Why am I willing to believe or disbelieve that? And if you just do one thing this week, if you keep those questions in your mind and think about them, then you've done something really great for yourself because now you're questioning the information that you're being given. Last week, the Senate held a vote. Oh my God, they held a vote! A vote! I know, earth-shattering, right? The House is ever taking votes. They're really good at taking votes, but at least folks in the Senate are. It didn't go the way that many of us wanted it to go, but at least they voted and they got on record. If it had all worked out, that vote would have, as I understand it, removed the 60-vote threshold, making it possible to pass voting rights legislation, in theory. So tonight, we are going to make like Marty McFly, because history is important, and get into our DeLorean, fire up the flux capacitor, and hit 1.21 gigawatts, not gigawatts. It was gigawatts in the movie, and it wasn't supposed to be. It was a misspelling in the script. Oh, the things you're going to learn on this show, I'll tell you. Well, we're going to go back in time, and we're going to put some things in perspective. So I want you to have an open mind. Now, between 1525 and 1866, understanding that these numbers are not exactly... I wouldn't say not accurate, they are estimates. We really think that this is pretty close, but we could be off a bit, but not that much. So between 1525 and 1866, 12.5 million Africans are shackled, sold, and forcibly placed into slavery. Of the 12.5 million, 10.7 survived the passage to wherever they were headed. Of the 10.7 million Africans to survive, 388,000 made it to North America, the remainder being transported to the Caribbean and South America. By 1860, there was a total Black population of 4,441,830. Of that 4,441,830, 488,070 were free. The rest were enslaved. Around 11%, give or take, if we're rounding up. 11%. To give you some perspective, since this has been a big football season these last couple weeks. I'm really upset the Bucks lost. But since this has been a big football season, Michigan Stadium can hold 107,601 fans. So that number of enslaved Africans is a little over four Michigan stadiums. By 1870, 10 years later, 5,392,172 Blacks resided in the U.S. Ellis Island won't open for another 22 years in 1892. Once open, 12 million immigrants would pass through Ellis Island in 62 years. As a factual point, no passports or visas were required. No papers of any kind were required. When my great-grandfather and great-granduncle came through Ellis Island, and they did, their names were changed. Each walked off the ship sharing the same last name. Both walked out the gates with two different last names, completely different from the one they arrived with. It's 1870, that same year, the 15th Amendment was ratified. It says, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States, or rather, shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude." At least on paper, it gave Blacks the federal legal right to vote. But in the South, they found a way around those efforts. Jim Crow laws existed and were strengthened. Now, not to be confused with the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, named after the late great representative from Georgia, John Lewis. Jim Crow refers to not a real person. It's a reference to a derogatory caricature of Black people in a song and dance called Jump Jim Crow, performed in blackface by a white actor whose name was Thomas D. Rice. So, if you didn't understand what the big deal was about why people, white people, shouldn't be wearing blackface and why it's so hurtful and shameful to do, now you know. These Jim Crow laws, local laws, separated people by race, restricting where Blacks could go and even sit. These laws acted, among other deprivations, to deprive Black people that right to vote. Realizing that the 15th Amendment wasn't enough for the folks down south, in 1875, the federal government enacted the Civil Rights Act, intended to eliminate discrimination. However, in 1883, in an 8-1 decision in the Supreme Court, it effectively struck down the law. That lone vote was cast by Justice John Harlan from, wait for it, Kentucky. I know, Kentucky. He pointed out the hypocrisy of the court. Though the majority claimed that Congress had no jurisdiction over private persons or corporations, the court had for years held the opposite view that upheld the Fugitive Slave Acts, which authorized Black slaves, human beings, to be seized and returned to their owners if they escaped onto federal land or from one state to another. This decision essentially robbed the 13th Amendment banning slavery and the 14th Amendment granting equal protection under the law of any real meaning. It wasn't until 1964, 81 years later, after the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, with the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, did the Supreme Court disavow their prior decision. That's a long freaking time. If the Civil Rights Act of 1964 sounds familiar, it should. It's commonly known by one of 11 sections or titles. Title VII, which prohibits discrimination in employment. The act does more than that. It helped to strengthen voting laws. Hopping back into the DeLorean, let's jump to 1957. On May 17, 1957, Martin Luther King Jr. gave a speech at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., referred to as Give Us the Ballot. Now, Martin Luther King Jr. was an extraordinary orator. And when you have the opportunity to hear these speeches in his voice, that's what you do. I'm not going to play the entire speech, but there's one part I'd really like you to hear. Please listen.
"3 years ago, the Supreme Court of this nation rendered in simple, eloquent and unequivocal language a decision which will long be stenciled on the mental sheets of succeeding generations. For all men of goodwill, this May 17th decision came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of human captivity. It came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of disinherited people throughout the world who had dared only to dream of freedom. Unfortunately, this noble and sublime decision has not gone without opposition. This opposition has often risen to ominous proportions. Many states have risen up in open defiance. The legislative halls of the South ring loud with such words as interposition and nullification. But even more, all types of conniving methods are still being used to prevent Negroes from becoming registered voters. The denial of this sacred right is a tragic betrayal of the highest mandates of our democratic tradition. So our most urgent request to the President of the United States and every member of Congress is to give us the right to vote. Give us the ballot. And we will no longer have to worry the federal government about our basic rights. Give us the ballot. And we will no longer plead to the federal government for passage of an anti-lynching law. We will, by the power of our vote, write the law on the statute books of the South and bring an end to the dastardly acts of the hooded perpetrators of violence. Give us the ballot, and we will transform the salient misdeeds of bloodthirsty mobs into the calculated good deeds of orderly citizens. Give us the ballot, and we will fill our legislative halls with men of goodwill and send to the sacred halls of Congress men who will not sign a Southern manifesto because of their devotion to the manifesto of justice. Give us the ballot, and we will place judges on the benches of the South who will do justly and love mercy. And we will place at the head of the Southern states governors who have felt not only the tang of the human, but the glow of the divine. Give us the ballot, and we will quietly and nonviolently, without rancor or bitterness, implement the Supreme Court's decision of May 17, 1954.
That 1954 decision he refers to is the case of Brown v. Board of Education, which in a, if you can believe this, unanimous 9-0 ruling overruled Plessy v. Ferguson. Brown declared separate but equal unconstitutional. It allowed a little girl in a third grade to go to school 7 blocks from her home instead of walking 6 blocks to a bus stop to take a bus to ride 1 mile away, all because she was Black. Pick a feature of your child. Let's try hair color. Black hair or blonde hair. Just because your child had that hair color, they had to walk 6 blocks to a bus stop to take a bus and ride 1 mile away to go to school. Would you be angry? Why aren't we as enraged when we think about what Black people have to endure every day? Well, we are safely back in 2022. Safe, of course, being relative. There's that virus raging, and here we are still talking about voting rights. Tonight, I am super excited about our guest. Our guest tonight is a staff attorney at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Her name is Poi win a chuckle. And I am so excited for her to join us. Welcome. Welcome to Deep Dive with Dr. Tracy.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm glad that you're here. There's so much about voting rights that, to be honest with you, I don't understand, and I'm an attorney. And so I'm really excited to have someone with your background and experience, and certainly from such a tremendous organization like the Southern Poverty Law Center. Now, could you tell me a little bit about what the Southern Poverty Law Center does?
Yes. So the Southern Poverty Law Center is an organization in the Deep South. We operate primarily in five states: Florida, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. And we've been around since the 70s, fighting hate and fighting for racial justice. And we work across a bunch of different areas to ensure that we are we're fighting on all those issues in all of those focus states.
And one of those areas is in voting rights.
Absolutely. And you have said it before, I'm a staff attorney with the Southern Poverty Law Center in our voting rights practice group. And my focus is on Georgia. I'm based out here in Atlanta.
And there's a lot going on in Georgia, but we're going to get to that. So I am one of those people that when I went to law school, terminology was really important to me. I remember studying that first year, cracking open the textbook the first day and passing by a word and saying, oh, I'll get it later. And then remembering that, wait a minute, someone might ask me a question about that word someday, and going back and saying, now I got to learn what it was. I think it was demur, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that was a tough one. I remember seeing that too. And just, unlike you, just skipping ahead and pretending I didn't read it.
I still have to look it up. I swear. It's one of those things that's just a mind block for me. I don't know why. So terminology to me is important. If you don't know what the words mean, you have no idea what's going on in the world. So I'm hearing a lot about redistricting. Can you explain what redistricting is?
Sure. Yeah. And that's a tough one. And especially with legal terminology and oftentimes words kind of being used the same, same words being used in different contexts makes it especially confusing. So with redistricting, we can take it all the way back. Redistricting is a process by which we draw district lines that determine who are the types of candidates you can vote for, who you're able to elect, and therefore hold accountable. So every 10 years, the U.S. Census takes basically a count of all the people who live in the United States, and they have a better sense of this. And the U.S. Census does this count every 10 years based on a provision in the United States Constitution. So we have to do it every 10 years. And then what they do is they provide the data to all of the states, and then the states provide it to all of the localities, that's cities and counties. So everyone gets this data, and every single time you are voting for someone that has kind of any office, whether that's your city council person, your county commissioner, your state legislator, your congressperson, these are all people who have to be elected in particular districts, or usually have to be elected in particular districts. And so we want to make sure the U.S., with the new U.S. Census numbers, that you're only in districts with the same amount of people. They're roughly the same size, because that's where you might have heard the term one person, one vote. And that ensures that districts are roughly the same size. So every 10 years when we get this new data, we got to go through this process called redistricting, which is literally putting down new district lines just to make sure that everyone is in the what we call an apportioned district, or that the district sizes are about the same size.
Do they shift a lot from each sort of decade to decade?
I think that depends, and it also depends on which state or which locality you're in. So, for instance, in Georgia, we saw one of the largest shifts in terms of demographics as well as population. I believe Georgia is something like the sixth largest increase in population compared to the rest of the states in the United States. And so you can see also in Georgia, even in comparison to the other states in the Deep South that the Southern Poverty Law Center works in, you also see a lot of people moving within that state. So not only did we increase in population overall, but we also saw people moving around a lot, which means that you got to draw district lines differently depending on where all these people live. Whereas some other states, especially in the Midwest right now and sometimes in the Northeast, we saw actually a decrease of population. And so that requires also redistricting because now people have moved away or moved around.
So it's a normal government process that we go through every 10 years or so. And it's designed with a purpose to ensure fairness. But I guess what I understand is that it hasn't been fair. Is that correct?
It can oftentimes be unfair. Yes. And that's where we get to another term that some people might have heard before, gerrymandering. And this is an old term coming all the way back from a legislator in Massachusetts and that's where, you know, we get his last name that bears this term. But gerrymandering is basically the manipulation of the redistricting process to draw lines in favor of one thing or another. So you may have heard the term racial gerrymandering. So that's an adjective attached to gerrymandering, meaning that they're manipulating the lines in order to draw certain people of a particular race in or out of a district. You might have heard the term partisan gerrymandering. Same concept, but the idea is to draw certain people of a party in or out of a district to advantage one party or the other.
How do they go about doing that? I mean, is it primarily in places where there's it's not forced segregation anymore, but segregation happens as a result of economic status and financial ability.
So Tracy, are you asking how they go about racial gerrymandering? How is that
done? How does that work? I mean, I for folks that don't understand, they may be living in a place like I grew up in New Hampshire. So when you said Massachusetts, I get a little wisty over that because, you know, growing up in New England, I'm proud of that. And but yet at the same time, like if you were to look at New Hampshire in comparison to Boston, you know, Massachusetts is a different place, particularly, you know, in Boston and thereabouts. New Hampshire's got two districts, and if I recall correctly, and I'm just trying to think of, you know, for us that wasn't a big deal, right? Because we really weren't that racially diverse. But for other places where that may be the case, how does that work? Do they pretty much know where everybody's living and they're sitting there on a table? I remember having a case once where we had to draw boundaries. It was a probate case, and I remember the lawyer throwing his tie over his shoulder, and the two of us were trying to draw how this property was going to get broken up between two people. And so that's an image I have in my head, is sort of they're drawing out these boundaries and they sort of know where everybody is based on that census. And they're drawing these wacky lines to try to exclude certain people or to sort of pen them into different districts so that they are potentially less represented. Is that really what's happening?
Yeah, so it's not so much that there's a big map and then you take pen to paper. I think a lot of redistricting now is done through software, but the concept still kind of remains the same for racial gerrymandering. And it's almost exactly the way that you described it, Tracy, where you get the data that's presented by the census. And like you mentioned, it shows where people live, not precisely because we don't want to give away private information. So no one should be scared that the U.S. Census is just delivering your information out there. But it kind of gives kind of a rough sketch of where people live in terms of the demographics and things like that. And so then what the software does is then you're basically just drawing. And it will provide and run different types of numbers, whether or not, for instance, you can see where cities are split up or how compact the district actually is. And there's a lot of statistics and things that you can do with the software nowadays. But in terms of racial gerrymandering, it's still the same concept that you're using race. And you're manipulating race in order to put people into certain districts or take people out of districts, with the effect being that you can change how much strength their vote has. And whether or not, like I said, the principle of redistricting is whether or not you get to vote for certain candidates or be able to elect certain candidates and have them represent you.
Okay, that's really helpful, and that we sort of break this stuff down, because these are concepts that get thrown around in the news all the time, and you know, there's really no opportunity to sort of stop and say, hey, what is this? What does this really mean? And the same thing applies to legislation. You know, one of the things that Democrats do really well is give names to things. You know, I'm a Democrat. I wear it broadly on, you know, I should have a patch. And so I don't hide my politics on this show. And I recognize it, I own it. Legislation has these great names but they don't really tell us what it says. And what I have noticed with this administration, I love this administration. Actually, President Biden, graduated from my law school. Now, granted, he graduated from my law school very, very long, long time ago, you know, comparison to me, but I'm proud of that. And so, you know, they're doing their best. They walked into a mess, an incredible mess. I can't even imagine what it was like for them. You know, the plumb book had been tossed up and ripped into shreds, and there was, you know, chaos everywhere. He had to fire people who wouldn't even leave their appointed posts. I mean, it was just a mess. And then people were dying left, right, and center, and the hospitals were being overrun. I mean, I don't even know how, like, he's gotten it this far, because this place was a mess. Sort of like a ransacked rental that was left behind. And so, that means messaging sometimes takes a back seat, and messaging is really important for the public. And so the federal legislation that had been proposed, one of the laws was named after John Lewis, Representative John Lewis. And so I'm wondering if you could share with us some of the things that were contained in that legislation that were important.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because it also takes us to why this moment is so critical in voting rights. So I'll start first with just what's in the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. And what it really gets to the heart of is restoring protections for voting rights that we've had in place for decades. The clip you showed earlier and talked about earlier mentioned the Civil Rights Act of 1964, or you previously mentioned the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And then a key piece of legislation after that, just the year after, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, is one of the main tools that exists for us to protect voting rights. It's something that I use every day as an attorney to help make sure that everyone has equal access to the ballot. What the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act would do if it had passed, and if it does pass, is that it would restore a key part of this legislation, a key part of the Voting Rights Act that was stripped away in 2013 based on a Supreme Court decision called Shelby County versus Holder. What this key provision did for many decades, again, since 1965, continually enforced and renewed by Congress until 2013, was that it gave the Department of Justice jurisdiction to just take a second look at legislation that would change election law. Because for so long, as we know in our history, there were states and other localities and jurisdictions that were rolling back voting rights for people based on the color of their skin, based on their income level. And so in 2013, Shelby County versus Holder, that decision said, nope, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to let the Department of Justice take a second look just to make sure, basically, that this that these laws were not discriminatory. And so without that, since then, we've had an onslaught of election law changes in states like Georgia, where I work in, that have rolled back voting rights and move forward with these kinds of discriminatory laws that the Voting Rights Act was set up in the first place to protect against. Now, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act would just simply restore that, what we call Section 5 preclearance. So it's Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And so, unfortunately, Congress was not able to restore that portion of that law. And so now we are still in our, it's since 2013, almost a full decade now without these protections, without the second look that the Department of Justice should be taking. And so we're seeing not only increased laws all across the country that are rolling back voting rights, but we're also seeing even more new ways that these election law changes are being implemented, including in our first redistricting cycle, going back to things we talked about previously. It's our first redistricting cycle without Section 5 protections.
Okay. So the DOJ was sort of a watchdog that could step in when something just didn't smell right, didn't look right, didn't act right, was violating someone's rights. And that was taken away as a way to make sure that folks could vote in this country. Is that correct?
Yeah. And even more than that, it was only a watchdog for states and jurisdictions that had been proven bad actors, right? So people who would violate laws and put in place discriminatory rollbacks to voting year after year after year, documented history of that. And that's who the DOJ would be able to take a second look at, to be able to be a watchdog for. And like a train wreck coming a mile away that you can see it, that's exactly what we've got right now, where you take away that watchdog and it's open season on voting rights in those jurisdictions.
So why don't why don't we talk a little bit about what's going on in Georgia? I'm gonna get comfortable because I understand there's a lot going on in Georgia. I know Stacey Abrams has done a bang up job getting people registered to vote down there. But what else is going on down there?
Yeah, and this is the stuff that doesn't always make the news, right? So voting involves a lot of different things. It's not just about being able to get to the ballot. It's not being able just to get to the polling place and literally cast your ballot. Now we have absentee ballots. Now we have, you're able to sometimes request your absentee ballot online. you're able to use some drop boxes. And there's different types of voting, different types of voting methods. There's also redistricting we talked about as well, which affects the strength of your vote, who you're able to cast a ballot for. And so all of these things are happening in Georgia right now. We're seeing polling place consolidations, meaning that in some places like Lincoln County, there are 7 polling places that are now being reduced to 1. The proposal is to reduce them to 1, meaning that people from all corners of the county have to travel in to 1 polling place. That makes no sense, especially in rural areas where there's no public transportation and limited access, especially for other people who already have access issues, like people with disabilities. You're also seeing kind of other little issues that don't necessarily make the news, like local redistricting efforts. We talked about redistricting. It happens at the congressional level. It happens at the state legislative level. But it also happens for your county commissioners or county school boards. And in Georgia right now, that process is currently happening right now, without very much oversight. These bills are just passing without the ability for the public to see them, to comment on them before they become into law.
I've got so many questions. The consolidation, you said Lincoln County, how many people reside in that county?
It's just over 7,000 people. But this is, you know, the concern here is that these are the exact type of things that the DOJ would have had normally been able to double check, like to really question and have the resources to kind of look into why does this need to happen? What kind of effect does this have on people who are people of color? What kind of effect does this have on people who live far away from the one polling place that remains open in the entire county? So this is just the first that we'll see. And I wouldn't be surprised if we'll see more actions like this throughout the state in the coming year.
What about the consolidation just seems, it seems, you know, I know from being an attorney and, you know, having done administrative process and whatnot. I mean, there are usually meetings and hearings that are held to sort of justify why they're doing what they're doing, or to, you know, for them to take statements and testimony and whatnot. What's the justification for closing all the polling places except for one?
I think a lot of justification is cost, and that might be the only one that I can think of. You know, it's not my preference to close down these polling places and consolidate so there's only one in the county. But I do think that election administrators have been very constrained in the past year. They faced a lot, had to do a lot of hard work. There was a lot of scrutiny. Yet their budgets haven't increased. They don't have any additional resources. And so they're having to work with and deal with an onslaught of harassment, intimidation, increasing election administration requirements because of these new election law, big election laws that are forcing more scrutiny and even more rollbacks on voters while increasing pressure on election administrators. So I do empathize with that. But the answer here is not to address a problem that was fabricated and created by making it harder for people to vote.
Right. And I hear that. And at the same time, you know, to me, you know, I guess I wonder how you're challenging these things. Are you challenging them on constitutional grounds? Are you challenging them on insufficiency of, you know, based on sort of different burdens of proof standards? You know, I mean, when somebody, the government can restrict your rights, but they have to meet certain levels of under certain burdens of proof. You know, when I think about that, I think about First Amendment, and I think about different, you know, strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny, all of those things. And so, you know, rational basis test seems to not sort of fall in the, you know, in the same sort of level here. And when I hear about funding for polling places, especially since most people are volunteers who are counting these votes and things, and these are buildings that would be open anyway, but for the fact that you're voting. And so I'm curious, what's the weapon of choice for a lawyer like you to challenge these things?
Well, the most we always challenge, you know, even though I talked about the Voting Rights Act before and how Section 5 watchdog or preclearance provision here doesn't exist anymore for the DOJ to use. We, as voting rights attorneys, still use the Voting Rights Act in many ways. There are many provisions that still provide protections for, say, language minority populations. So limited English proficiency populations where there are people who rely on and predominantly speak a different language than English in order to be able to cast a ballot. As well as other protections, for instance, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act that was enacted to kind of supplement and create this kind of effects standard. So you don't have to prove that there was intentional discrimination, but just that there are disparate effects based on for people who are people of color. We also challenge we're able to challenge things under the Constitution. The 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause simply says that people should have equal rights. It's a little bit more complicated and detailed than that in particular situations, but that's the gist of it, right? And going back to the precursors to the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, we've got the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, right? We've got these amendments coming out of the Civil War era that provide protections for people based on, so that they're not discriminated based on the color of their skin.
Now, I want to turn back because you said something about the Department of Justice and preclearance. And it wasn't one of the things about the Department of Justice preclearance piece was that the burden shifted. It shifted to the states to prove that it wasn't discriminatory, or do I have that wrong?
Right. So Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, first, the steps would basically be that if you're one of the jurisdictions that that the DOJ was a watchdog over, that you would have to submit your election law changes to the DOJ first and say, can I do this? And then they'd have a chance to review it. And then they would issue, if they said it was discriminatory, they'd have to issue something called an objection. So it'd be an attorney general's objection to that election law change, and then detailing why they thought that this change wasn't appropriate, because it would be, the magic word here is retrogressive. The idea is it's literally a rollback reminiscent of old voting rights obstacles that in the Jim Crow era that would be implemented to block people from voting. And so you can always, some of the jurisdictions felt they didn't like these objections. You could contest them. But the standard here would be that the jurisdiction has to show that the voting law change was not retrogressive. So there is that kind of burden shift as well.
Now, what other things are they doing in Georgia that we should be mindful of?
I think the biggest thing, I started with all the things that aren't that are a little under the radar, but I think the biggest thing that folks might know about is the big law, the big omnibus 98 page law that was passed after the 2020 elections. And this big law, SB 202, as it's now infamously known, changed the entire scheme of how elections are run in Georgia. Everything from how all the various ways you can cast a ballot and have it counted. So absentee voting, early voting, voting by drop box, and in-person voting. It created obstacles for each of those methods of voting, as well as it changing the way that ballots are having to be counted. There's a provision that basically you have these election administrators now have to essentially count the ballots until without stopping. And that's because apparently some people were mad about the delays in some of the election results in 2020. And so, you know, this count till you drop kind of provision stretches election administrators and their resources, just like we were previously talking about as well.
I'm still stumped at this idea why folks can't vote. Like why is it so, why are they taking this approach? Is it simply because they lost an election? I hate the simplified answer of it's racism, you know, and that comes from, you know, my research and implicit bias and bias generally, but, you know, I'm just trying to understand, you know, why they're doing this and why does somebody in California, I'm in Los Angeles, why do I care what's happening in Georgia?
Yeah. You're asking all the good, big questions. You know, I think it's difficult to put your brain in a mindset like that, but that of why someone would try to trample on someone's rights and try so hard and desperately to do it. But I think that is the exact context point. Georgia, for instance, I mentioned our population has grown. Our demographics have changed. We are almost a majority people of color state. And as we all now know, as a result of all the elections that happened in 2020, we know that Georgia is now a pivotal political state with 16 electoral votes. So we're on the map in many different ways now. And all of those things combined, I think, scare people. It really scares a lot of the people who have been in power for decades, people who are used to holding their offices, wielding their offices to get what they want, and not having to really serve people or people broadly or certain people, namely people of color, that are their constituents, that are residents of Georgia. So now we're facing, because of those fears, I think there are a lot of people who are trying to now wield their power over people's rights. And that's where, you know, it crosses a line. I think it crosses a line well before then. But that's what they're resorting to in order to fight the change that is happening, to fight against you know, people demanding representation, people engaging and trying to protect their rights. They're doubling down and trying to ensure that they can hold on to the last bits of power that they're used to having.
So now that I feel hopeless and very frightened, even though I live in a very blue state, in a very blue county, what can people do? Because I know, you know, Democrats can marshal and galvanize like no other when they want to. And hopefully we've explained why they want to. But what can they do?
Yeah, I would, you know, there's lots of different ways to engage. At SPLC, we host phone banks to make sure that voters are getting information, especially about these recent election law changes. You know, we're one of many groups that is challenging this law, but until then, it is currently law, and it's important for people to know what their rights are under this current law and how to still cast a ballot and have it counted even now. And so we encourage people to get involved that way. The other thing about voting rights, and this ties into something that you mentioned earlier, Tracy, about why people maybe in Los Angeles or in kind of areas where there may be fewer problems with voting rights or less aggressive problems with voting rights should really care about voting rights and what they can do. Voting rights is something that is we want to be universal in this country. There are probably voting rights violations in your backyard, and any voting rights violation, anyone trampling on someone else's rights should be concern all of us, regardless of where you are, you know, where you live, who represents you, what political party you're part of. And it's important to engage even where you are to make sure that voting is accessible. And only that way can we show other people, you know, we can look to the example, hopefully one day, of voting in California and voting in Los Angeles, that will help us try to meet that standard in Georgia. You know, these states look at one another, too, to make sure that they're keeping up with one another. And so if you can work on voting rights where you are as well, that should help everyone make sure that we all have the representation that's equal and accessible.
Now, you can also, if you feel it's out of your ability to do some things, there are other things that you can do, which is to support the Southern Poverty Law Center financially. I believe that you folks take donations. Is that correct?
Yes, that it's not quite my department as an attorney, but absolutely. We are a nonprofit organization, so we don't do this to make money. But anything that folks give does go to supporting our work.
Wonderful. I know that I'm going to have lots more questions. You made so many things tonight so much more crystal clear than they were. And so I do hope that you'll agree to come back and see us, because I know that these things are becoming more and more dire as the days go on. It was wonderful to have you. Poi Winnechuckle, the staff attorney at the Southern Poverty Law Center in the Voting Rights Group. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I gotta tell you, I feel very anxious when I hear about this stuff. It's distressing to me because it's not in my mindset for me to want to deprive someone of their rights. I remember the first time I voted. It was 1992, and I was in college, and I was in my college dorm room, and I had gotten my, my absentee ballot, and I was living near New York City, and I was really excited to fill out my absentee ballot, because it's one of those moments that I remember, like I was ascending the summit to adulthood. Voting in my family was a given. I remember bundling up and waiting in lines outside the high school in a small town in New Hampshire. My parents took me each and every time they voted. Some of that had to do with that I wasn't young enough. I was young enough that I couldn't stay home alone. But I like to believe it was also to model some behavior. You voted. And it was just, it wasn't something they had to tell me I needed to do in the future. When I moved to college, I got my absentee ballot and I voted. I remember one hot and testy election where my mom wanted to vote for, I think it was Mondale. And no doubt, I believe, because it was Geraldine Ferraro, the first woman to ever be on a major party ballot. She was at that time, she was on there as a candidate for vice president. And my dad said he wouldn't take my mom to the polls unless she voted for Reagan. And this sort of back and forth thing happened all the way until we got to the polls. I mean, this went on for a while, and it, you know, I suppose looking back on it, it was sort of healthy ribbing, but it was ugly nonetheless, if I think about it in detail. And I remember my mom saying to me after we left the little booth with the red and white curtain, I voted for Mondale. Now, years later, my dad would vote for Democrats. But when it came to be my turn, it was never a thought in my mind that my vote wouldn't count, that someone would challenge it, or that it was going to be made impossible to acquire a ballot, or that it was going to be made hard to drop off the ballot, or that I was going to have to stand in a line with 7,000 other people. And that's what privilege does. We refer to our country as a democracy, but it isn't. It's a democratic republic. And it means that we have to vote for the folks that represent what we believe for our voices to be heard. And our votes have to be valid. How many polling stations there are, whether you can vote by mail, which for me, who has had to be really careful in light of COVID, is important. Whether my ballot comes to me or I have to request it, how I have to request it, whether you can even vote by mail, whether I can engage in the stream of commerce by, hello, Constitution, ordering something to be delivered to me as I stand in line for hours. Look, Democrats are really great when we have an enemy to hate. We galvanize like no other. We will march in droves. We will get ourselves arrested peacefully, mind you, over health care. We will march over certain rights, women, abortion. We will protest when Blacks are senselessly murdered. But when it comes to voting rights, when there's a Democrat in the White House and we're in control of Congress, we excel at shooting ourselves in the foot. We're really great at that. The time to take action is now, folks. It's now. It's not later. You got to get fired up about this stuff. You got to be playing the game like Trump is in office and you want him out. You have to. Otherwise, we're going to be back where we were in absolute chaos. I want to thank you for being with me this evening. It was a lot of fun hearing about some new information that I didn't have, and I hope you learned something. My goal here is always to take that needle and the knowledge meter and point it toward more. Next week, we're going to be back with this amazing, 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 amazing show. I am so excited about it. We are going to be talking about whistleblowing, and I have as guests, I have attorney Jordan Thomas. Read the New Yorker. He was featured in the New Yorker on Sunday. And I also have Tom Mueller. You may know his name, not Robert Mueller, Tom Mueller. He's the writer who wrote about whistleblowing, and he also has a book out about exposing the olive oil industry. So it's going to be a fun conversation, and I hope you'll join me. I wish you a good night and a great tomorrow. Thank you for joining me.